The socio-economic decline of much of the Arab and larger Muslim world plays an indirect role in generating the new terrorism. It contributes to the disparity in power, influence, and prosperity that fuels resentment. But for the most part, the participants in the jihad against the United States have not been poor. This is true of Al-Qaeda operatives, and it was true of Takfiri renegades in Egypt as well. Some may be the victims of frustrated expectations. Having anticipated a financially secure middle-class lifestyle, they find they cannot attain it in a region that has failed to mesh gears with other globalizing economies. This is economic misery of a sort, but not the relentless, grinding poverty afflicting half the region's population. The link between socio-economic trauma and terrorism lies in how the imagery of poverty fuels the anger of middle-class terrorists. Revolutionaries from the mid-19th century through the end of the 20th were similarly motivated. Traditional societies the world over are reeling from the impact of globalization, which arrives wearing the face of American popular culture. Poverty is endemic in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, as well as in the Middle East and North Africa. Only Al-Qaeda has counterattacked with a campaign of violence that aims for total victory through annihilation of the presumed source of these evils. The catalyst for this campaign, the necessary condition for it, is religious conviction. In this case, the conviction has been shaped by a specific interpretation of Islam, deeply rooted in classical sources and emerging from a long tradition of violent Islamic reform movements. This pattern of religious belief has transformed a constellation of cultural conflict, political confrontation, and socio-economic calamity into a cosmic war between good and evil. The metamorphic process eliminated the possibility of compromise or mundane resolution because the offended party was Allah. God's partisans cannot bargain over the fulfillment of his will. Doing so would substitute man's judgment for the rule of God. So total war is unavoidable. The situation is hazardous, but not hopeless. The United States possesses enormous wealth and capable allies, and is at the leading edge of technological development that will be key to survival. An integrated strategy that takes into account the military, intelligence, law enforcement, diplomatic, and economic pieces of the puzzle will see America through. For the next few years, the objective of such a strategy will be to contain the threat, much as the United States contained Soviet power throughout the Cold War. The adversary must be prevented from doing his worst, while the United States and its allies wear down his capabilities and undermine the support he derives from co-religionists. Success will require bipartisan commitment for this containment strategy at home and the dedication of a strong coalition abroad. These two key ingredients, bipartisanship and prudent diplomacy, must ultimately be supplied by whatever administration is occupying the White House. In developing a sustainable strategy, we need to recognize important distinctions that have been muddied during the first year of the war on terrorism. First, Washington should avoid putting Palestinian terrorism into the same rhetorical basket as jihadist violence. Arafat is not bin Laden. Both use terrorism, but that's where the resemblance ends. Arafat uses it tactically, bin Laden uses it strategically. One wants to pressure an opponent, the other to wipe him out. Equating them confuses not only the American people, but also the allies on whom we depend. This does not mean that Arafat's use of violence should go unanswered or be accepted as the cost of doing business on the way to a Palestinian state. It does mean that it is not Arafat's terrorism, but bin Laden's terrorism that threatens the United States with mass casualties. Arafat's terrorism will presumably diminish when he is replaced by a responsible leadership seriously focused on state building. No such outcome is conceivable with respect to the jihadist zealots in bin Laden's camp. This distinction is so important because America needs allies in the war on terrorism. Most of our allies differentiate between Arafat and bin Laden. They understand the need for extraordinary cooperation and determination in destroying bin Laden, but not Arafat. By equating the two, the United States alienates friends who see themselves being caught up in a never-ending war led by a world power incapable of distinguishing between existential threats and tactical ones. Second, Saddam Hussein is also not bin Laden. Saddam is determined to overturn the regional balance of power. If he is allowed, he will pose a mortal threat to Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, and probably Iran. He can achieve his dream of hegemony only by deterring American intervention, for which an Iraqi nuclear capability is essential. Saddam must be contained or unseated.